This week, we reach into our past episodes to highlight Belden Lane's wilderness spirituality. We released this episode in the month of May, a time, at least for those following academic calendars, of busy travel and end of semester business. This isn't a new episode with Belden Lane, rather, we appreciate his thoughts and careful consideration of the wild spaces of the soul so much that another chance to listen to his episode is always welcome. Just in case you missed it, Belden Lane, Professor Emeritus of Theological Studies, American Religion, and History of Spirituality at St. Louis University, talks with Matthew Wickman, Founding Director of the BYU Humanities Center, about several of his recent books. These include two that beautifully combine attention to nature, the long tradition of Christian mystical writing, and the rhythms of Lane's own spiritual life, and ours as well.
Great to have you on the program, Belden. Thank you.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you, Matt.
I ask our guests how they imagine their faith in light of their work. In your case, you write powerfully and sometimes really achingly, poignantly, about ways your scholarly life not only opened avenues for spiritual inquiry, but also in some ways stifled them. And I'm wondering if you would speak to the complexity of your life of learning relative to your life of faith.
Well, my faith journey has been an interesting one. It was raised in a Southern fundamentalist setting with revival meetings and Bible memorizing. Served as a pastor of Presbyterian churches for 5 years in the Northeast, and then the last 35 years teaching with the Jesuits here at St. Louis University. It's all been part of a good journey. Ignatius Loyola says we find God in all things, or we should, and that's certainly been the case as I've loved being absorbed in the great tradition of the church in all of its dimensions. So I've loved it, my years of teaching, but I've also in recent years come to call myself a recovering scholar. Because there's something of an addictive character of an academic life. You live in your head so much of the time. Analyzing becomes more important than experiencing. And you come to pride yourself on all that you know. And it was very curious to me. I've been retired now 6 years. That was harder than I expected when I retired, because I didn't realize I'd had so much of my identity invested in being a professor. And recognizing then the danger of knowing about holy things instead of loving and delighting in holy things. Mm. I love the French philosopher Paul Ricoeur. He talks about three stages in one's thoughtful growth in one's life. The first is a first naivete, he says. And that for me, I was about 10. Bible church started up down the street. I went with it with my family, my mother and father. Was stunned by the story of Jesus. Started writing my first book at the age of 10 in a little spiral binder. But then as I grow up in a very rigid setting, I begin asking questions too, especially going into high school, college, and move into what Ricoeur calls a hermeneutics of suspicion. Where you begin asking questions, the hardest questions you can. And that's very necessary. I kept a book at the university, Florida State, where I went, taking all the atheist professors I could and all the reasons for not believing that I could find. But then Paul Ricoeur says, you don't want to stay either all the time in the first naivete or in this hermeneutics of suspicion, which is what a university setting tends to encourage. And so he speaks of moving into a second naivete, where you recover the wonder of that original mystery and yet carry with you still a critical sense. And that's been the journey that I've been through in terms of my academic life. Yeah.
That really speaks to me. I'm not a recovering scholar. I'm still in the middle of it, but I'm trying to figure out how to negotiate these stages you're talking about, which I feel very powerfully in myself and my own experience. I've written about experience. I'm drawn to experience, but knowing experience is the thing that you do at the university, and that knowing can overpower the experience. And that's the trick.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you've written well, several really amazing books, but two of them, the most recent ones, at least that I've read, unless you've got others that I don't know about. But the two, one of these is titled Backpacking with the Saints, Wilderness Hiking as Spiritual Practice, published in 2015 from Oxford University Press. And wilderness spirituality is a theme you take up there. And I'm wondering if you could explain to us what wilderness spirituality is.
Yeah, I use the term in both a literal and metaphorical way. What I'm really trying to talk about is a life of faith that takes you to the edge. It involves risk. It's a matter of losing the control you think you have to have so much. And entering into a liminal space where things break loose. And that may happen literally on a trail when you're hiking in wilderness. Oh, Lord, I was lost once in the outback of Australia and scared me to death. And it can happen metaphorically right at home, struggling through a divorce, the death of a child, a life-threatening illness. That's when wilderness comes to you. Mm-hmm. And what happens in either case is that the ego becomes radically challenged. And that's when the spiritual life turns a corner and real possibilities are opened. And I found that again and again in my own life.
That's fascinating. And you really conjure all of that beautifully in these books. And one of them, I think the next book, we'll talk about that in just a few minutes here, The Great Conversation, you mentioned getting lost in that outback. And I was harrowed on your behalf reading about it. I would have passed out right there. But you're a more experienced wilderness adventurer than I am, I think, so you made it okay. I was lost in the wilderness once in a desert on a motorcycle. I got away from the rest of the group, and I didn't know what I was. I was 14 years old, and that was enough of an outback for me.
Yeah.
You describe wilderness spirituality as involving four stages or patterns, the call to adventure, the assumption of discipline, the descent into darkness, and then the return to freedom. And it's a mythic journey. And I like how you express this, this kind of life on the edge. We go into it or it comes into us. So wilderness really is for you a metaphor for something more elusive and difficult to name. That's just a comment, not a question. Let me ask about this then. You also mentioned some paradoxes that are implicit to wilderness spirituality. And I'd love to get your sense for this. For example, you observed that self-realization begins with self-abandonment, that community is framed by solitude, that spiritual growth is best achieved through failure, and so on. And I was wondering, in reading these books, whether your theological training and your familiarity with paradox helped you perceive the wilderness differently. Or maybe you'd turn that around. You'd say that it's your familiarity with the wilderness that gave you a deeper feeling for paradox.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. And it has to be both. Although a theological training involves a great deal of prosaic memory of information, especially as a church historical theologian, as I was, but I learned early on in my teaching and in my wilderness wandering that paradox and metaphor are really the only ways ever of beginning to speak adequately about holy things. Paradox, the idea that two things can be true at the same time. Metaphor, the idea that speaking of something familiar in a crooked way suggests something what is unfamiliar, a kind of playfulness with language. That's what you're really invited to out in wilderness and in the theological enterprise, I think, at heart. And if you really want to get to what a theologian wants to understand, I think of George Herbert, that wonderful English poet, who's trying to talk about the love of God. How does he put it into words? He says, love is that liquor sweet and most divine, which my God feels as blood, but I as wine. Mm. Now, you could never put that in a logical syllogism, but as poetry, as it beautifully touches the heart with what matters most.
I love that.
So poetry and storytelling have been primary means for me in my teaching and writing both.
Yeah. Well, you do it beautifully. I love how you say that the only way to begin talking about the holy is through paradox or metaphor, or I guess the third storytelling. These are, and the stories you tell really are metaphors for a lot of these larger experiences. You're a beautiful writer, Belden, and so many passages in your book incite me to contemplation, whether from the elegance of a story or how you describe a natural setting or the poignancy of some observation. If I may, I'd like to read you one passage from that book, Backpacking with the Saints, then ask you to comment on it, all right? Here's that passage, and I'm quoting here. It's near the beginning. You write, hikers invariably carry two packs on traveling into wilderness. I can adjust the straps of the one easily enough, but releasing the other is beyond my skill. It holds the things I've come to relinquish, my stubborn insistence on going the wrong way, the fragile reputation I try to nourish back home, a failure to hold myself accountable as a husband, father, and friend.
Yeah. I'm always finding that there are two kinds of baggage I'm taking with me. Not only what the 30, 35 pounds in the pack that will get me through my body through the next few days, but the baggage that I bring inside. And it's curious, it always takes me the first 12 to 24 hours to be present, to be able to let go of that inner baggage. I love the Desert Fathers, as you've seen in most all of my writing.
Right.
And
for those who aren't familiar,
are great foremen.
Yeah, and those who aren't familiar with Desert Fathers and Mothers, it's early Christianity. It's like what, second, third century?
Yeah. They began going to the desert. They're critical of the Roman Empire and its emphasis on consumerism and militarism and the cultivation of one's personal reputation. So they go out in the desert. It's very interesting. They go into a wild terrain that is totally indifferent to them and all their accomplishments, all the baggage they bring of what they've done, who they are. And it's curious to me that they develop a spiritual practice of holy indifference themselves. They call it apatheia, a holy indifference to unimportant things. Let me tell you a short story that says this beautifully.
Yeah, please.
There was once a young man in Alexandria who'd heard about these wonderful desert fathers and mothers. And so he walks all the way to one of the monasteries and he meets Abba Macarius, the abbot there. And he says, oh, Abba, I've heard you desert fathers, you're wonderful holy men. I want to be a holy man too. I only have the weekend to be here. Can you teach me how to be a holy man? Well, you can imagine Macarius smiling, but he takes him seriously. And he says, well, I tell you what, I want you to spend the rest of the day over at the cemetery. You'll see it across the rise there. And I want you to abuse the dead for the rest of the day. I want you to throw rocks at their stones. I want you to call them thieves, robbers, miserable wretches who made the world worse because of their having lived. And say everything mean you can. Well, the guy thinks this is strange instruction on how learning how to be a holy man. But he does as he's told. Comes back that evening, Abba Macarius says, well, what did the dead people say to you today? They didn't say anything. They were dead as doorknobs. Oh, that's interesting, said Macarius. I want you to go back tomorrow, and I want you to praise them for all you're worth. Say every compliment that you can, that they're apostles, saints, righteous men and women. Think of everything good you can. Again, he does exactly as he's told, comes back that evening, and Macarius says, what did they say to you this time? Nothing more than yesterday. Ah, they must indeed be holy people, my friend. You insulted them and they did not reply. You praised them and they did not speak. go and do likewise, my friend, taking no account of either the scorn or the praise of other men and women, and you too will be a holy man. That ability to let go of all that seemed so important out there in the society they had left, that's the baggage that they needed to learn leave behind. And me too, as a recovering scholar.
And well, me too, as a still practicing scholar. That's not been easy for me. I'm trying. That's a great story. Thank you for sharing. Let's turn now to your most recent book, 2019. You published a book called The Great Conversation, subtitled Nature and the Care of the Soul. And this book really blows me away. I ask myself how many lifetimes I'd need to be able to write something like it. Can you explain what you mean by this great conversation? And you say it's accompanied by a great turning, perhaps another term that you can explain for us.
Yeah, Thomas Berry was a Passionist priest, wonderful man involved in very similar to Teilhard de Chardin, who was his teacher. He complained that people had dropped out of the great conversation. That phrase is his. We've lost, he said, our ability to converse with the rest of the natural world, something that we as humans did for thousands of years. But since the Enlightenment especially, we're talking only to ourselves, he complained. We're not talking to the rivers. We're not listening to the wind and stars. We've broken the great conversation. And what concerns me is that this is a loss spiritually for us. And it's also a danger in that it allows us to destroy a world that we once held in reverence. I think of Richard Love's book, The Last Child in the Woods. He spoke of the problem of nature deficit disorder. That is true of our children, but of all of us, that we've gotten away from a deep spiritual connection with the world around us. So Joanna Macy is a fascinating spiritual teacher who describes a great turning, a change in consciousness that is underway as we're moving far beyond the Enlightenment in our day. A sea change from an I and it relationship to the world to more of an I and thou sense of communal identity. Teilhard de Chardin called it an evolution of consciousness, that he saw that as the evolutionary process had developed all different kinds of species reaching up to our day, there is something of a movement now of a evolution of consciousness, especially we as human beings carrying that as a great responsibility of ourselves, but a consciousness that spreads beyond the human to the rest of the world as well. He calls it the planetization of humankind. We become really identified with the planet as a community, and to think like an Earth community and not just like separated individuals.
Okay, great. You know, one of your interesting conversation partners throughout the book, just on this very subject, is an old cottonwood tree near your home. What prompted you to begin attending to this tree, you know, caring for it, loving it, eventually talking to it?
Yeah.
I love that part of the book, by the way. It's great. It's a great part of the book. I love it. That's why I'm curious about it.
A grandfather and I met about 30 years ago. My mother was dying of cancer with Alzheimer's disease. He was struggling with a lightning strike and a windstorm that had just blown down one of the two great trunks growing from his roots. So it's very interesting to me that we met at a time of crisis and woundedness for each one of us. There's a big 12-foot-high wound in the side of this tree where the half of it had been disappeared, cut away. And a common hurt drew us to each other. I'm convinced that a shared vulnerability is at the heart of any deep communication, whether it's human to human or human to more than human. So we've developed a practice. I go over to see the tree every day for some 20 years or more now. In the last 10 years, a deliberate practice of praying with him, leaning into that hollow in the night, being still, invited into a still greater stillness by the tree. And as I move in that kind of contemplative stillness, things will come to mind as my mind is emptied. It's not unlike contemplative prayer. And I'll hear, something will come to mind or heart, and I won't know whether it comes from me or from him. To be very personal and honest, our son, our 41-year-old son, the father of our granddaughter, Ellie, 5-year-old Ellie, died of cancer this last year during the coronavirus epidemic.
Oh, wow. I'm so sorry.
So a lot of my grieving has occurred in connection with the tree. And grandfather will say, I'll hear him say, or without words, that I have been ripped apart too. And I know what that is like. And I can remind you that everything you really need will come to you. You don't have to go anywhere else. And only a tree can say that. You know, a tree can't go anywhere else to get the nutrients, the water, the whatever it needs or wants. And so when a tree says that, I listen. And it's this strange kind of connection between the tree and I. It happens not because of any paranormal skills that I have at all in listening, but simply when you spend a lot of time over years with something that you learn to love and spend time with, something happens. Yeah.
It's a very powerful idea. It communicates powerfully in your book. I didn't know about your son. My condolences there. Though I think that your relationship with living things, that tree, that sounds like a very profound way to arrive at some deeply poignant lessons, understanding about these things. You know, that I've been wounded too, as you say, the tree says, communicates to you. Let me ask you about some passages in this just glorious book of yours. You know, each of the chapters, they kind of weave together different things. There's some kind of natural setting, a mountain, a desert, an island, a cave. There's some kind of discussion of a writer from the mystical tradition. There's some kind of personal reflection in there. You communicate, or you talk about various stages of life, you know, childhood, youth, you know, older age, etc. And I can't get all of that into these passages, but these are just, I want our listeners to get a feeling for this book because it's just so beautiful. So I'll read you a passage and you can comment, okay? Here's the first one from the middle of the book. You write, "This is how a parched land knows water, achingly, desperately, with a passion bordering on dread. It's also the only way we ever know God."
Yeah. It's always fascinated me that the Hebrew word for knowing, yada, is this word that's used to describe Adam knowing his wife, entering into sexual intimacy with her, and the same word used to describe the children of Israel knowing their God as they move through the wilderness. Knowing is not just a gathering of information. Knowing God, you can't know God as an object, as something you can pin down, as if theology or even a search for spiritual experience were like pinning butterfly wings onto a display board, something you've captured and pinned down. It has to be a matter of deep intimacy, of becoming one, with all the risk and the vulnerability involved in that. And so we only know God achingly, desperately, as I have done in these last few months especially. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure. Thank you. It's beautiful. Here's another one. And all these are so profound, Belden, but here's another one. You write, "Sculptors, like glacial geologists, attend what takes shape as small bits of the world disappear over time. Perfection is finally attained not when there is no longer anything to add," says Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, "but but when there is no longer anything to take away. It's an important principle in the spiritual life as well. Subtract whatever is superfluous.
Yeah, I love Meister Eckhart's caution that the spiritual life is not about addition, it's about subtraction. And we are so prone to think that we need to add another spiritual practice. We need to learn more about yoga or more about contemplative prayer or more about this or that new technique, or we need to get out there and do more good in the world, which is certainly the case. But Eckhart said that the core of the human spirit in terms of spiritual life is subtracting all those things of the ego that thinks that we are the one acquiring. We're the acquisitive ones that are gathering, adding more things to make more of ourselves. Whereas all that God wants is for us to be stripped down to simply the naked self that we are and to be loved in that way. Yeah.
It's such a profound thought. I'm curious, Belden, do you feel like you had an instinct for that principle when you were 25 or 30, or is that really something that came to you over time? Because I know myself, what you say there resonates so deeply with me, but I have been for such a long time such an acquisitive being, even if only acquiring experiences or acquiring projects or acquiring things to do good in the world. Did you have a feeling for this when you were younger, or is this the wisdom of really a more mature person?
Yeah, certainly the latter. As you can see, as we're looking at each other on this Zoom connection now, you see all those books behind me.
I do.
Impressive. I've gathered all these books as if thinking just possessing the books was possessing all the knowledge and wisdom within them. It's very interesting. I've given away thousands of books in the last 6 years. And I think there it's a very unusual 20-year-old who is able to recognize the importance of subtraction.
Okay. Well, I'm in my mid-50s now. I don't feel quite so badly. I'm learning this lesson. I'm getting there slowly. Here's another passage. And these are all just so beautiful, I find. Here's what you write. You say, "It's not our accomplishments, but our failures that occasion our deepest healing. There in the bottomless void, forsaken by those who should have loved us, and having forsaken those we should have loved, we find acceptance, not accusation. In heaven," says Julian of Norwich, the 14th century mystic, "we won't be ashamed of how we've been wounded or how we've wounded others. We'll wear our sins as a badge because that's what got us there. Grace isn't won by our having done it right, but it comes by our having failed and been forgiven."
That is probably the most important truth that I continue to need to live in my life. That's the gospel. That's good news. That we don't have to, we don't receive God's love because we earned it, we deserved it, but simply because of grace. That's something that coming out of my background, where judgment, God's anger was so predominant, to be overwhelmed by God's love is an amazing thing. Let me tell you a short, wonderful story out of the Muslim tradition that says this so beautifully. There was a disciple, a man who came to his Sufi master one day, and he said, "Master, I've done terrible things in my life, and I know Allah can never forgive me. What can I do?" And the master said, "My son, we are all connected to God by a piece of rope that is the same length for every one of us. And you're right, alas, when we sin, we cut the rope that connects us to God. But know this, that when we repent, God is so anxious to tie a knot in that rope to reconnect us. And of course, as you know, every time you tie a knot in a rope, it gets a little shorter. And as a result, we get closer to God every time we sin. So trust in the forgiveness of Allah, the merciful and compassionate. God loves to tie knots." I love that story.
That's beautiful. I love it. I love it. That's a great story. And what you say.
And you know, that's very Pauline too, in terms of Romans 6, where Paul says, you know, he's virtually saying the same thing, that God utterly forgives. And he says, so do we sin that grace may abound? Of course not, he says. But that's the logical kind of question that arises out of this sense of uncommon, utterly unresistible grace.
I love that. The message of grace is such a beautiful message. And thank you for sharing that story from the Sufi tradition. That's really a great way of rendering language to that principle, making it vivid. One of your chapters, you describe a search for wolves in Yellowstone, and you never manage to see the wolves, but the evidence of the wolves is all around you, and you build that experience into an elegant metaphor about the existence of God. You write this: it was enough to have been part of their territory, knowing a presence just beyond the trees. We were moving through something we couldn't see, but nonetheless knew to be real. The wolves were a humbling reminder that what I long for most, I'm never able to see. Embracing what can't be seen, can't even be known, may actually be the first step in renewing the great conversation.
Yeah, it's being brought to a deep humility again, that you go out there to see the wolves, to have some sense of mastery control. We never see God directly. Like Moses, we're in the cleft of the rock and we see the backside of God passing. We see only the footprints or vestiges of God, as St. Bonaventure said, but they're scattered all through the world, the creation. We just see enough now and then to keep our desire going, to want more. I love in T.H. White's novel, The Once and Future King, the Arthurian story, that Sir Pellinore is one of these crazy knights. He loves dragons, but he's never seen a dragon. And he keeps looking in the forest everywhere. Every once in a while, he finds a dragon fumet, and that's dragon poop. And he goes into ecstasy when he finds this vestige or remnant of the dragon having been there. And I think that's much of what the Christian life is about. Peter Matheson, in his marvelous book, The Snow Leopard, talks about trudging through the Himalayan wilds, looking for this very elusive wild cat, the snow leopard, and never seeing it, but knowing that he is seen by it, and knowing that what we can't see, but we are seen by in a great mystery, is more powerful, certainly sometimes, than the actual seeing itself.
Great. Yeah, that's really profound. Seeing just enough to have a desire for more. That certainly has been my, just enough of an experience to want to experience much more. That really carries with me. Toward your conclusion, you write this. It's a great passage, and it's a really profound thought. You write this: might God be less involved in controlling or directing than in accompanying, giving space, standing alongside, like a parent providing loving support to a growing child? The world is in evolution, John Hott suggests, because God is a God of persuasion rather than coercive power. Evolution occurs because God is more interested in adventure than in preserving the status quo. In giving the world its freedom, however, God must love with God's heart in his throat at times.
Well, you know, if you take wilderness seriously, as I've had to, giving myself to it through the years, you have to accept the reality of life, death, mystery, all the things that seem unexplainable and sometimes awful in wilderness. And yet I wouldn't want to live in a world without thunder and lightning. I don't want to live in a world where everything is tied up nice. The wildness of God is a part of God's love for me. I don't need rational explanations about why cancer took my son this last year. But I do need a God who is wild, who struggles with me, wrestles with me, who holds me to her sobbing breast as God travels with me through struggle, not inflicting suffering, but walking with me in it. And so questions are efforts at theodicy, of trying to explain God's ways in the world, of making everything nice with God, are really, I think, an insult to God and God's grandness. God doesn't tie up all the loose ends. God enters into the messiness of the world with us. And that's where we discover the reality of the Christian faith.
Absolutely. On that very note, you write something about Christ, and I love the way you evoke Christ in your book. And I wonder if you could comment on this passage then too. You write that you see the cross as a sign of God's own radical participation in human and other than human suffering. It is God saying, "You're not alone. This is where I myself dwell, in the dark, empty place, not as a cause of suffering, but as a shared presence within it." At times, you continue, "I wonder if God shares in the world's pain so that God won't be lonely either. How does the Holy One make it through the night, after all, given the agony of all he has to bear? In the cross, you don't find an almighty God so much as a God who consents to being all vulnerable, walking alongside us at great personal risk." Such a poignant insight, I think, in the nature of the divine being and the promise of our own experience of the divine, Belden. I wonder if you could comment on that for us.
You know, the cross, as the Apostle Paul said, is a great stumbling stone. It is the crux of the Christian faith. That God's radical way of influencing the world is through an utter vulnerability, not through an authoritative controlling power, so that God doesn't stand atop the world, pulling strings as an interrupter of nature, interventionist, but that God lets the natural realm operate in the laws of nature that God has set through the evolutionary process. And God himself stands at the bottom of the world alongside the victims, challenging all claims to power, enticing people to an irresistible love, while at the same time pulling us toward a future that is full of hope. This is not just a God that is helpless, but a God who is moving, as Teilhard de Chardin says, luring us toward a new reality that is taking shape, even in this day when it seems there is so little reason for hope. And God works on the underside of nature and society again and again. That's my hope.
That's the kind of God I want to hope in and believe in myself. Mm. Absolutely. Well, let me ask you a question. It may sound like a trick question. It's not meant to be a trick question. I'm trying to get at something kind of that you maybe already nuanced for us, but here's the question. So as someone who cares deeply as you do about ecological flourishing, the flourishing of all life, all creation, what do you see as more dangerous for the planet? Widespread beliefs that God is almighty or that God is not there at all?
I think my image, I know my image of God has so much to say about my image of myself. And so if I imagine God to be almighty in the sense of holy, other, distant, powerful, pulling strings, then I'll tend to be that myself. My dealings with others, with the natural world, will emphasize dominance, tending to be vertical. I'll want to be in control, mastering things. And there's an immense danger in that. maybe more so than even and many people that I work alongside of in terms of ecological work do are not believers in God at all, but they have a great love of the natural world. And so, on the other hand, if the first thing that is to be said about God is love and intimate presence accompanying us in our struggles, what we see in Jesus, then I want to echo that in being loving myself. As I said, I grew up with an almighty punishing God. And one of the great things I've been entering, I guess I consider myself more evangelical now than I would have called myself in the past, because the faith I claim now is really good news. It was scary as hell back then. Yeah. Now it is good news. Yeah.
I love how you say, I don't have this passion. I didn't mark it. I should have. It's marked in pencil. I quickly will find it right now at the spot. But you talk about how we come to an appreciation for this great conversation. And you talk about how we have to spend time in the presence of something, eventually coming to understand it more fully as a function of that attention. And eventually we love the thing that we are there around. You mentioned God is love. I think those who love nature, whether they are believers in God or not, they've adopted something of that very process, right? Where they've come to understand and love and therefore can identify with, they care for. Whereas the other one, you know, kind of the belief in a God who's other and almighty, that really does put us at a remove, at a distance that's awfully dangerous for this world in which we live, not just from the planet, but from other people who don't think as they do.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Absolutely. Thank you.
So I read, you know, the first book of yours I read was the book Ravished by Beauty, published in 2011, right? And its subtitle is The Surprising Legacy of Reformed Spirituality. And I thought, man, what a book. And then I read Backpacking with the Saints, and I thought, okay, Belden Lane found his supreme, you know, sort of his magnum opus right there. Then I read The Great Conversation, and that was still more, to me, more exalting, a vision of the world. And I have been convinced you could not keep surpassing yourself with your next book. So, and I've been wrong again and again. So I'm curious, are you working on anything new at present?
Yeah. I've been invited to switch gears in a radical way, entering into my old age. And I have this five-year-old granddaughter, Ellie, that I dearly love, my wife and I do. And I'm working on a children's book. It's a middle grade book, imagining Ellie to be about 12 years old at that time. She and a couple of her girlfriends are very concerned because Grandfather the Tree is about to be cut down by the City Parks Department, because the plan is to build a monument to the logging industry in the state of Missouri. And this old battered tree would be in the way. And so the girls, along with Babu, who is in his doddering old age at this point, they fight for this tree. And I would love to be able to finish that in the time I have left. I've been having to set it aside because of the whole grief process in the last few months. But my dream is to be able to get back to this children's book. Yeah,
I think that sounds beautiful. It sounds beautiful. You are really, Belden, a lovely human being. You are so good to talk with me today on this podcast. Your work is fantastic. I've been turning friends onto it in as much as I can. Hopefully those who hear this conversation we've had will be drawn to it as well. It rewards the reading very much. It's very thought-provoking and very moving work that you've done. Thank you for accumulating. That's a wrong word for it. Thank you for assimilating and growing into these insights that you've shared. It's really a privilege.
Thank you, Matt. Delight to be able to talk with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.